Welcome to this deep dive, where we take complex topics and pull out the crucial insights. Today, we're zeroing in on a really significant legal case, American Honda Motor Co. v. Allen.
Mm-hmm.
For you law students tuning in, this case is like a prime example of how expert testimony gets scrutinized very early on in class action lawsuits, and how that scrutiny can really shape the entire case.
That's right. What makes American Honda v. Allen so interesting, I think, is that it puts a spotlight on this, you know, fundamental question in class actions.
Yeah.
When a case is trying to represent a big group and it hinges on, you know, scientific or technical expertise to show a common harm, how rigorously should a court look at that expertise before letting the case go forward as a class?
Right.
It's not just like ticking a procedural box.
Okay, so let's unpack the situation then, what led to this legal question. It involves owners of Honda, Goldwing, GL, and 800 motorcycles who claimed a design defect was causing this pretty unnerving low-speed steering wobble. Now, for our listener, it's important to understand why this alleged wobble is so central to the class action part of the case.
Precisely. Because, you know, for a lawsuit to be certified as a class action, the plaintiffs have to show there are common questions, law and fact, that apply to the whole proposed class. And, importantly, that these common questions predominate over individual issues.
Predominate. Okay.
Yeah, think of it this way.
Yeah.
To have common questions that predominate, you need a shared issue affecting the whole group. So this certification stage is absolutely critical. It determines if one lawsuit can stand in for maybe thousands of individual claims.
Gotcha. And in this Honda case, the plaintiff's strategy for showing this widespread defect, this common issue causing the wobble, it really leaned heavily on their expert witness, Mark Ezra. What exactly did Ezra bring to the table here?
So Ezra, he was an expert in motorcycle engineering, and he introduced what he called a wobble decay standard. Essentially, he defined a wobble as defective if it didn't, like, dissipate down to 37% of its initial amplitude within half a second.
Half a second. That's specific.
Yeah, very specific. His argument was if the wobble lasted longer than that, it showed a safety defect present across all the Honda Goldwing GL1800s in the proposed class.
Okay, now this is where it gets really interesting. Honda, unsurprisingly, wasn't buying this wobble decay standard. What were their main arguments against it?
Well, Honda launched a big challenge to Ezra's methodology using the Daubert standard. And as you know, Daubert gives courts a framework to check if scientific expert testimony is reliable and relevant.
Right, the gatekeeping function.
Exactly. So Honda pointed out several key weaknesses. They stressed that his wobble decay standard lacked, you know, real-world empirical testing. It hadn't been validated by the wider scientific or engineering community. There was no proof it had gone through peer review or been published anywhere reputable.
And it wasn't just about the lack of broader validation, was it? His own testing methods came under fire, too.
Absolutely. Ezra's entire analysis was based on testing. Wait for it.
Why?
One. One used Honda Goldwing motorcycle.
Just one. Seriously.
It's just one. So Honda argued, reasonably, I think, that this single data point was hardly representative of the whole class of bikes, new, used, different conditions. It couldn't reliably prove a defect across the board.
Yeah, that seems thin.
And they also pointed out that this wobble decay standard seemed to have been made up just for this lawsuit, you know, not from independent research or existing engineering principles. That raised big questions about bias.
So the district court hears all this, the wobble claims, Ezra's standard, Honda's Daubert challenge, and they have to decide on class certification. What do they do?
Well, despite saying they had some concerns about Ezra's testimony, the district court actually granted class certification, at least partly. But, and this is key, they denied Honda's motion to exclude Ezra's report without prejudice.
Without prejudice, meaning they could bring it up again later.
Exactly. The court basically said, okay, class certified for now. We'll deal with whether this expert testimony is actually admissible later on if we need to.
Which I imagine Honda wasn't thrilled about. Their whole point was that the basis for commonality was shaky from the start. So what was their next move?
You got it. Honda immediately used Rule 23. That rule lets you appeal a class certification decision right away. They argued the district court messed up by not fully dealing with the Daubert challenge before certifying the class,
yeah.
Especially since Ezra's testimony was pretty much the only thing supporting the idea that common issues predominated.
Okay, so that brings it to the Seventh Circuit. For everyone listening, this is where the core legal principle we're digging into really gets decided. What was the central question the Seventh Circuit had to tackle?
The big question was, does a district court have to resolve Daubert challenges to expert testimony when that testimony is essential for meeting the class certification requirements, especially that predominance rule in 23B3.
Right.
Or, put simply, can a court basically say, yeah, we have doubts about this expert, but we'll kick that can down the road when the expert's opinion is holding up the whole class certification argument?
And what did the Seventh Circuit say? Could they kick the can?
No kicking the can. The Seventh Circuit was really clear. They said, yes, the court must resolve it. They held that when expert testimony is critical to showing common issues predominate that core Rule 23B requirement, the district court must do a full Doebert analysis first, assess the reliability, the admissibility, before deciding on class certification.
So, no more putting off the tough Doebert questions if the expert is central. What was the court's reasoning? How did they apply those Doebert factors to Ezra's testimony specifically?
Well, the Seventh Circuit went through the standard Doebert factors pretty carefully for Ezra's wobble decay standard. First, they pointed to the big lack of testing. Like we said, just one used bike. The court said that wasn't nearly enough to reliably show a defect across a whole class of new and used bikes.
Makes sense.
Second, the absence of peer review or publication. This specific wobble decay threshold hadn't been vetted by other engineers or scientists, which raised serious doubts about its validity.
And the fact it seemed tailor-made for the lawsuit didn't help either, I guess.
Not at all. The court really emphasized that. It looked like it was developed specifically for this litigation, not from independent research.
Right.
That suggested, you know, a potential lack of objectivity.
Yeah.
And finally, the court noted Ezra's report gave zero information on a potential rate of error for his method. Without knowing the error rate, you can't really gauge how trustworthy the conclusions are, scientifically speaking.
So, applying Doebert, they found major problems. How did that connect directly back to Rule 23B3 and class certification?
The court made a very direct link. They stressed that Ezra's testimony was basically the only thing the plaintiffs were using to show the common issues the alleged defect predominated over individual differences among all those motorcycle owners.
It was the linchpin.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Without reliable expert testimony backing that up with a sound method, the plaintiffs just couldn't meet the predominance requirement of 23.3. The whole foundation for class certification crumbled.
And didn't the court have a really pointed quote about that?
Oh yeah, they stated it flat out. Without Ezra's testimony, plaintiffs are left with too little to satisfy Rule 23B3. That sentence really sums it up. If the essential expert testimony fails Doebert, the class certification built on it fails too.
Wow. Okay, so for our listeners, especially the law students trying to grasp the implications, what does American Honda v. Allen really mean for class action litigation going forward? What's the impact?
The impact is pretty big, actually. It makes Doebert a much stronger tool for defendants and usable much earlier, right at the class certification stage. It gives them a clearer way to challenge shaky expert evidence from the get-go.
So it could stop some class actions before they even really start.
Potentially, yes. If a core expert evidence doesn't pass the Doebert smell test, the class might not get certified. So what this really means for you as a student is seeing that these early stages are now major battlegrounds over the science itself. Defendants can try to dismantle a case early if the expert work is weak.
And flipping that, for plaintiff's lawyers, this means they need to be way more careful with their experts from day one, right?
Absolutely. This case definitely raises the bar. Plaintiff's experts can't just show up with methodologies that, you know, lack solid empirical backing, haven't faced peer review, or aren't generally accepted. You need robust, defensible expert work right from the start. The old idea of, we'll figure out the expert details later at certification. Much riskier now.
What about the judges? Does this change their job at the certification stage?
It does. American Honda clarifies that judges can't just postpone these critical Doebert decisions when the expert testimony is fundamental to certifying the class. They have to be gatekeepers and thoroughly check the reliability before certifying. It means getting deeper into the science earlier on.
Okay, let's talk about that hypothetical the source material raised. What if Ezra had done more? Say he tested 100 bikes, a representative sample, and his wobble decay standard had been peer-reviewed and published. How might that have changed things?
Yeah, that's a great thought experiment. It really underlines why the methodology matters so much. If Ezra had tested, say, 100 bikes, new, used, various conditions, and if his standard had gone through peer review and been published in a respected journal, well, the Seventh Circuit's analysis would likely have been very different.
How so?
Because those steps would provide much stronger proof that his method was reliable, valid, generally accepted. It would have massively boosted the plaintiff's argument that their expert could reliably show a common defect. Class certification would have been way more likely. The lack of those things was really key to the court striking down the certification.
Okay, so boiling it all down, what's the single most important takeaway for our listeners from this deep dive into American Honda v. Allen?
The core takeaway is this. American Honda locks in the critical role of reliable expert testimony in class certification. It says loud and clear. When expert evidence is the key to meeting Rule 23 requirements, especially predominance, courts must do a full, tough Daubert review before certifying the class. No shortcuts.
But early scrutiny really matters.
It really does. It can completely change the path and outcome of these big class action cases.
Definitely a crucial point. Now, for you, our listener, here's something to chew on. Given this focus on early expert scrutiny, how might this change litigation strategy in class actions? Will we see more intense upfront fights over expert qualifications and methods right at certification? Something to consider as you continue your legal studies. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.